Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here in the studio. And oh, boy, did I have fun today. I got to talk to Boots Riley. Definitely one of the coolest people I've ever had the pleasure of sitting down with. He's so cool. He made me feel like the squarest middle-aged guy you can imagine, even though we're actually only about a week apart in age. Turns out, though, Boots is a really nice guy. He has a new movie out now called Sorry to Bother You. I call it a satire, but we talk a little bit about the word satire in this interview. And I don't think satire is a dirty word. I think it's great. It's a comedy. It's very funny. He's very much making a statement about the current state of race and politics in the USA, but he does so through a very accessible lens of this film, which is odd and strange and funny. And his directorial debut as writer and director here in his mid to late 40s, which is really cool. He was best known as the leader of the hip-hop group or collective, The Coup, that is C-O-U-P. For many years, he made his name in music and is extremely talented. And check out The Coup if you haven't. It's great stuff. But I have a lot of respect for Boots for throwing us a change up here at 47 years old and making a movie out of nowhere and a very bold, brave first film, very confident first film, very impressive. So Boots's pick was Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters, the film from 1985 from director Paul Schrader. Very interesting film. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like it. It is a biopic about the legendary Japanese writer, Yukio Mishima, but it is, it's kind of hard to describe. The way that Paul Schrader approached this was unlike any movie I'd ever seen before as far as biopics go. He does it in four parts through through a black and white story of his real life as a youngster and growing up, and then through three other chapters through Yukio Mishima's books and the plots of these books and the story of these books, how they intertwine to also help tell the story of this man's life. And the way it's shot is just amazing. Really, really unique take. Very arty movie. And this was Boots' pick. Boots has a wide range of styles and influences, and it was cool to hear that this was his choice. So here we go with the great Boots Riley on Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters. Nice digs.
Yeah, man.
You're looking good.
I got like 20 suits and then 40 separate jackets and pants given to me, like gifted to me.
No way.
There's this woman that is runs a thrift store, a vintage store, that raises money to fund safe houses for girls to get away from their pimps.
Wow.
And they did a story on her in the newspaper, and then people came donating clothes. So one family that was a wealthy family, I guess, their parents had died.
Mm-hmm.
And so they donated all the clothes, and the woman had the mother had so many clothes, and she doesn't want men coming into the shop because sometimes she has the girls come working
right
there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so she was like, well, I want to give all the men's clothes to an artist. And I happened to be walking right by.
And you happened to be
and
the
she was
the
like,
right
try
size.
This jacket on. And I was like, this fits. And she was like,
uh-oh.
You know, take, you know, and there was garbage bags all over her floor
yeah.
of stuff. She was like, you know, whatever you want, take it. And I was like, can I have it all? she was like, yeah, good. Take
That's
it.
Quite a bounty. And
yeah,
then
yeah.
you can just mix
and
match.
All like, yeah, yeah.
Very nice. Where's that, that shop?
Oh, that's called Regina's Door. It's in Oakland, California. I live in Oakland, yeah.
Yeah, you know who I just had in here was, and I have a feeling you know these guys, David Diggs and Raphael.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I thought I had never met David. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew who he was, obviously, and I was like, it's strange I never met this guy. And so we met at Sundance, like, when our films were premiering.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, it's good to finally meet you. And he was like, no, dude, you already know me because I used to teach this art and organizing class
yeah.
At this community center. He was like, I was in your class.
Oh, wow. You That's know? Pretty cool.
But of course, he probably didn't have the facial hair and all that. Well, because he was 14.
Yeah,
or
yeah. He was a kid probably. Yeah, so yeah. I bet you were like, I bet he looked up to you a lot.
I don't know.
It's very cool.
Maybe he thought the class was bullshit. It's very possible.
I doubt it. He's a nice guy. He and Raphael were both cool, and their movie's great. Did you get to see that?
Yeah, man. It's exciting to see so much stuff coming out of Oakland. And they are definitely showing themselves to be a force in acting. And it's exciting to see.
Yeah, Oakland's really like, with you guys, with your movies coming out, with the Warriors the past few years, it's been like...
Now, if only we could get the rent cheaper so people could actually afford to be artists.
Yeah, yeah, that's kind of become a thing, huh?
Yeah, it's kind of a thing.
Like yeah.
Shelter.
Right. It's important.
Yeah.
Affordable housing. You and I are very close to age, actually. I was born in March 71.
Oh, shit. You're older than me.
Yeah, just by a few weeks. As you can tell by the gray beard.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about, let's go ahead and start with your movie. Sorry to bother you. Amazing achievement. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
I'm really curious about, first of all, you took the title from your 2012 record with The Coup.
Well, or was it's it? Actually the other way. I wrote the script.
Oh, okay.
And I had no connections in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured, okay, I'll make an album and, you know, maybe that will convince the record label to give me some money and then I can start putting stuff together.
Uh-huh.
They were like, nope. And
so you wrote the script in what, 2011 or?
I started in 2011, finished in 2012,
uh-huh.
Put an album out in what, like summer of 2012.
Yeah.
And but still... nothing happened as fast as I wanted it to.
Right.
So we had to put the album out and tour it because I needed money.
Mm-hmm.
And then soon it was 2014. By this time, the only person I had gotten it to was David Cross.
Right.
Yeah. And David Cross was the first person to sign on.
Uh-huh.
I actually sent him the script because we had done this show together and I had his information from a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, well, first I told him I had the script. He was like, yeah, send it to my house. And he now tells me he had no intention of ever reading it.
Oh, really?
But he was out of town,
mm-hmm.
and his assistant was house sitting and read the script.
Oh, man.
And then told him, you have to read this script. So then I had him on board saying that he was down.
Yeah.
And then so... somebody told me that Patton Oswalt is tweeting Coup lyrics. So
right.
I hit him up.
That's how you got to do it, you know?
And hit him up and said, you know, here's a script. Because even if you like an artist or whatever,
mm-hmm.
them writing a script is not necessarily something you're excited about.
Right.
Because, of course, you're a rapper. You want to write a script. You want to start a clothing line. You want to... barbecue franchise or whatever, you know, like it doesn't necessarily mean it's good.
Yeah.
And, I was able to say to Patton, look, David Cross likes it.
Mm.
So he read it and he was like, hey, I'm on board, whatever you want me to do. So those two were the first two on board. Then in 2014, I ran into Dave Eggers. And just actually ran into him on the street.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, I didn't bump into him and we didn't hurt each other, but I saw him on the street and he knew the music, but I was like, look, I wrote this screenplay. David Cross and Patton Oswalt think it's hilarious, but I haven't been able to get it made.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to just put it out on the internet. That was what I wanted to do, was just like,
release a script.
Just like with the idea of like, I'll never get this made, but I want people to know 20 years from now that I did it.
Right.
And maybe like somebody in the future will be like, we should do that movie.
Right.
You know, I found.
Be your legacy. Whatever.
Yeah. And, you know, so Dave Eggers read it and he said to me, emailed me what he then used as a way to promote the thing was, which was he said, well, this is one of the best unproduced screenplays I've ever read.
Mm-hmm.
And then he made it into its own paperback book.
Oh, wow.
And in, you know, screenplay form, but bound like a paperback book.
Yeah.
And packaged it with McSweeney's Quarterly. So that went out to like 10 or 20,000 people.
That's great.
And that was 2014. And while that whole deal was in place, I realized, okay, maybe, because he was like, look, everybody reads the script. I want to help you get this out there. You can get it made. And so I joined San Francisco Film Society as a filmmaker in residence. Went to Sundance with the actual books in hand to the film festival.
Right.
And met those folks. They invited me to apply to the Sundance Writers Lab.
Yeah. Did you get in that?
Yeah. Did the Sundance Writers Lab. Then they picked us for their Catalyst program, which is where 12 films each year make a presentation to 60 investors. And, you know, you get your time to make your pitch.
Yeah.
And that's actually where we met all of our financiers initially.
Really?
Yeah. So Forrest Whitaker and Nina Yang Bon Jovi's company, Significant, they were there. Macro was there. And CineReach.
Right.
They were all there. So I had met CineReach earlier, but that's where it came. You know, people got locked in. Then it's still, people still weren't convinced. Then when I went to the Sundance Directors Lab, then people gained a little bit more confidence in me.
Well, and at the Directors Lab, isn't that where you actually...
You
shoot
certain
stuff, right?
Scenes, nothing that gets used in the film.
Yeah, but just...
just kind of practice. And, although I did put out there that I had gone to film school. I started in film school.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask you that.
Yeah, I started in film school. We got a record deal while I was in film school. Mm-hmm. And it was at a time when even short films cost a good deal of money.
Yeah, because you're shooting on film.
Yeah. And so somebody was offering me money, which I thought was a lot. It was like $50,000 to record an album. I was like, oh man, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess I'm a musician.
Uh-huh. Accidental success there. Huh?
And So that's what I was doing. And that's probably why our songs were like a few, our more popular songs are long 8-minute songs that are telling these stories.
Uh-huh.
Co-directed a video, but really those aren't those things didn't, I don't remember.
Yeah.
You know that stuff.
As far as just the process of filmmaking?
Yeah, it didn't really, what did help me more was producing music, you know, being a music producer, working with musicians, where I might be in the studio with someone who people consider the best bass player in the world, the drummer who thinks they're the best drummer in the world, and a weird keyboard player. And individually, they all know much more about music than I do.
Yeah.
But I have to get them to follow my vision.
Yeah.
And not only just to do it because I say to follow the vision.
Right.
I have to get them to buy into it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also have to know, hey, that riff you just did right there is way better than what I had in that section.
Right.
That's what we're going with. And so.
Learn how to collaborate.
You have to be won over to, your ego has to be in the final product.
Yeah, sure.
And not in who. Who did what? And
right,
all that sort
like
of
in
stuff.
The process.
But yeah, and you also have to, because like the guitar player wants the guitar louder and wants a solo in this part and that part.
Right.
So often people that are really good at their particular thing, you know, aren't seeing the whole picture, and that's could be said to be true of actors and you know, anyone in the process, any technical.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I never thought about that as a training ground for film directing. It's kind of a similar thing. You're working with artists for a bigger vision, but everyone has their individual talents.
Yeah.
And you just got to lead the charge.
Yeah, you know, thing about film is luckily, you know, as opposed to music, you're not riding in a van with all these people for 10 hours a day.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and having to deal with a 2-hour fist fight between your keyboard player and your guitar player.
Yeah.
So
a little bit of a different world.
Yeah. But it trains you for the other craziness that's happening and the egos that everyone has, including yourself, and figuring that out.
Yeah. That's very cool that, I mean, you were, I guess, in your 40s going to these labs. Mm-hmm. All these years later, after going to film school, you're making your first movie as writer and director. Yeah. So it's kind of a crazy, circuitous way you got there.
Yeah. I mean, I think in general, doing things, following through on the thing you say you're going to do, is something that builds confidence and allows you to do other things, you know? You know, if someone who has built a house before tells you that they are going to swim the English Channel, you may believe them more than just someone coming out of the blue.
You know? That's very cool. I guess it gave you, you were probably a much more confident first-time filmmaker than you would have been in your 20s right out of film school because of the successes you achieved through the coup.
Maybe, yeah. And also, writing this script and pushing to get it made, I wasn't doing this in order to get a job in Hollywood. Right. I could care less about being able to do, you know, Expendables number 7 or something like that. Like, that's not what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to show that I can do what you need me to do.
Right.
I'm doing it because I have something to say and I have I feel like a way to say it that where the aesthetic makes a statement as well.
Yeah.
You know, and so that, you know, I could come to it on my terms.
Right.
You know, whereas maybe coming out of film school, you'd be like, wow, I have this chance, you know, I don't want to blow it. And I'm like, well, I'm here to blow my chance.
To serve as well to whoever gave you that chance.
Yeah.
Like, you're in a pretty good position in this one, I think.
Yeah. I mean, you want it to be successful, but you also want it to be successful on certain terms.
Right. Because you made your movie.
I spent all my life being broke because I wanted to do the art that I wanted to do and saying the things I wanted to say and in the way that I wanted to say it. So it's not, you know, I'm not going to then make something I'm unhappy with just for this chance now at the end of my life.
Did you feel like...
Yeah. It is. I mean, Patton Oswalt has that joke where he's like, you know, he's like, I'm in my 40s. They say it's midlife, but is it really?
Right.
You know, like,
yeah,
you got to be really healthy to get into your 80s and 90s. So,
yeah. You know. Plus, I think you get to our age and so, you feel the clock ticking a little bit.
Which pushes me to be like, I have a lot of movies to make.
Good.
You know?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So this is the beginning of phase two.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's all kind of been one thing. But having going 20-something years since film school with collecting ideas and being like, this would be a good movie, that would be a good movie. I have a lot of ideas, but I think I have like 14 good ones ready to go.
Yeah. That's good news for the rest of us.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about working with Lakeith Stanfield. I mean, he's kind of one of the biggest, hottest stars out there right now. And I hate using that word, but hottest actors. So,
and that's lucky for me because when we met up, he had only been, you know, I think it was like Short Term 12.
Right.
And then, and you know, he'd done like a bit part in a Oliver Stone movie. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he had done other things, but they weren't out. Uh-huh. And then when we met, I had only seen 2 episodes of Atlanta.
Right.
So I was like, oh, is this the guy? Whatever. Mm-hmm. But we met up at this cafe and he was just crazy.
Yeah.
He was crazy in the right ways and he was hungry and he was flexible. When I first was meeting with people for this role, there's a scene in it that calls for full frontal nudity from the person that plays Cassius. And we ended up not being able to shoot it for time because the reasons and the reason why I let it go was that, just kind of backtracking, is that I was like, first I said to him, look, we need people to feel Cassius at his most vulnerable.
Mm.
That calls for him being full frontal nude scene and this thing, which it wasn't a sex scene. It was just him standing there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that's part of the role. There's no talking around it. And he cut me off. He said, I've been waiting for a role with full frontal nudity.
That's great.
And we didn't end up shooting the scene because the vulnerability is right there in his face.
Sure.
And also we just had to cut something because we ended up shooting 61 locations.
Oh, wow. And how
40
many days?
Something speaking roles, 28 days.
Man,
and
that's tough stuff.
Which I'm realizing now, because everybody be like, this is ambitious. This is, and I'd be like, you're supposed to be ambitious.
Yeah.
But what I realized was going on is like, if I had done a movie before, I would have been like, oh, that's too many.
Yeah.
we're not going to get, that's going to be crazy. And then I would have cut it down. And all these details that are in the movie, these little things, and even saying the location number and the number of speaking character numbers doesn't really tell it because the production design is detailed.
Oh, yeah.
Jason Kisvarde did an amazing job.
Yeah, visually it was just unbelievable. Yeah. So cool.
And, costume, like some of the main characters, especially Detroit, Tessa Thompson's character, changes outfits every single scene.
Yeah.
And changes looks, the whole like look of her face.
Yeah,
and
that
everything.
Takes a lot of time.
And so, yeah, for me, it was just like, that makes it more interesting, which it did. But other people, producers and stuff were like, this makes it more expensive or less likely to get done.
Uh-huh.
And, but we ended up cutting very little out of the movie.
Do you feel like that you are, do you feel like you had a kind of a wide berth of doing the movie you wanted to do while also, you know, I know that when the producers come on board, the realism hammer hits you in the head pretty hard, but do you feel like you really didn't have to compromise too much?
Actually didn't have to compromise too much.
That's good.
There are plenty of arguments and debates about compromise.
Right.
But I was, I knew that what this movie had to offer was a different way of telling stories, especially for independents, because that's kind of what it ends up being is like, you whittle it down to the easiest thing to do.
Right.
And it ends up being two people on a couch talking and then in a bar talking and then on the street walking away from each other.
Right.
And, you know, that ends up being your movie. And so there ends up being, even though independent is supposed to mean like freer, it ends up going into this box.
Right.
And so I really didn't want it to do those things.
Yeah.
And I was able to do it because, I mean, even though this was a union shoot, we had to, I lived in Oakland, so we were able to get locations for free.
Yeah, yeah. Extras probably.
Art that existed was already around. I could get, my friend Gadenji did the art that Tessa Thompson's character does.
Oh, really?
Omiru is what he's going by now. And and so there were all sorts of things that we could do to make, to make it be possible. And even like when you are paying extras and you want to get a crowd scene, it's hard. But because I'm in the Bay Area, I could generate enough excitement to get crowd scenes.
Yeah, that's very cool. Well, I told David the same thing. Like, you only get to make that first one once, you know? It's like a truly special experience. Because then you have the knowledge
and you've almost been spoiled or ruined a little bit going into the second one, but it also makes you a smarter filmmaker. So sort of a give and take, you know?
Yeah.
There's something kind of cool, though, about that first, that naivete going into that first one, you know?
I don't know, because I haven't done my second one.
Right.
But, yeah. but
I'm sure
yeah.
that's coming soon.
Hopefully I'll hold that naivete. I think there's a Carlos Santana, of all people, had a crazy interview I heard him doing. This is related to it, but he was talking about, this is going to get, he was talking about how when he was a kid, he was molested, and but it was by a woman, so he didn't think of it that way at the time, and but started going into this talk about why older people are attracted to younger people, and even when it is legal and, you know, whatever. The point is that he starts talking about is that when we're young, everything is new, right? We have that naivete that we're so excited about learning new things, even though sometimes we're headstrong, we think we know a lot, we still feel that new information coming in and things seem excited. But the system gets us to the point where by the time we're in our 30s, we're told that we know all there is to know, because that's a way for us to, you know, be okay with just going to work and doing the same thing over and over. There's nothing new to learn. And so be more responsible and be productive in the way that you're supposed to be productive.
Yeah.
And people start getting depressed with that, and they want to feel like the world is new again. And so when they get around young people, then they can feel like the world is new. He claimed that what he was able to do was make sure he understood that there's always something new to learn. There's always something, and that every day he consciously finds new stuff and looks at new stuff around him physically in the world. And that's what I hope to do as a filmmaker as well, is to constantly be exploring something new, as opposed to being like, I know exactly what I'm doing. I know how to do this.
Right.
You know,
it's about being open.
And that's what I've done with music too, much to the chagrin of some of our fans. You know, we're always like, I'm always having to look for that thing that feels new and exciting.
Yeah.
And now it's gone to film.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what makes a true artist, you know, being open to that in your life. You know, it's very easy to shut that down, I think, even as an artist. So that's very cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, so what about your visual inspirations for this movie? I mean, it was such a, visually, it's such a cool looking movie. And it kind of reminded me of like Michel Gondry and how it worked with the satire. It was just kind of a perfect mix. So who are your inspirations?
Yeah, well, definitely I like Michel Gondry, but I think some of the inspiration is just, well, so for instance, with music, we use Pro Tools, but I have this theory that I don't like stuff just going from the keyboard straight onto the computer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sound needs to hit the air first, because it does something that I think we haven't calculated yet.
Right.
And we hear it in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that same thing with practical effects versus CGI.
Yeah.
Like, besides the limitations of CGI and the fact that, you know, like, well, one, you could have a skyscraper stand up and walk a block over and take a shit on the movie, and it wouldn't impress you.
Right.
It doesn't feel like anything.
Mm-hmm.
But when something happens in a real space, it feels substantial, and it really, so that's kind of where I take it from. And definitely Gondry does that a lot. There are other filmmakers that, you know, from like David Cronenberg and things like that, about things about the movie that I don't necessarily want to talk about.
Right. But,
that guide, that idea. But there's let's see, there's Gondry, there's Emir Kusturica, there is Kubrick, there is definitely Spike Lee. there's...
Well, the color palette, Spike's color palette always just knocked me out, and that kind of reminded me a little bit with what you were doing, just bold colors. And
that was kind of something we found as we went, you know, with Jason and Jason Kisvarde, the production designer, Doug Emmett, the cinematographer. A lot of this was, I had like a lookbook that was, you know, 1,000 images maybe. Yeah. But who else? Parajanov is someone. He does these very slow movies, not like I want to make at all, but has these framings of these big wide shots with like so much detail in them that you really need to take a still shot of them and to really take it all in.
Right.
And I think who maybe was influenced by that person as well was, what's his name? Holy Mountain. Jodorowsky.
Jodorowsky.
Holy Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
You know Holy Mountain.
I don't think I do. I need to.
Well, you saw Jodorowsky's Dune, right?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so he made Holy Mountain, and it has all these beautiful, you can tell there was someone production designing it, you know, as opposed to Parajanov, where it has those same big wide shots, and his Jodorowsky's colors are more bright and manipulated. But so I love all that stuff.
Yeah,
I don't like the preachiness with which like Jodorowsky comes off with, and some of those things. So we wanted to put all that stuff in there. The camera movement, the energy of camera movement. Of trying to think what movie had, but we wanted an energy in the way the camera moved through the space.
That really came across.
And but a lot of it ended up being like, you know, our locations were changing and things like that. And
yeah, you got to be nimble.
Yeah, and we're like, okay, how do we get something good out of this? And how do we, you know, some of that was, you know, luck. Some of that was, you know, was just me and Doug like figuring it out right then sometimes.
Yeah, that's kind of the test of a filmmaker, I think, is that, you know, you can do all the planning in the world, but like on the day, shit happens and you gotta be nimble and figure out like how to get what you want and while losing something that you wanted.
Yeah. And honestly, like, sometimes I might, like, there's a shot that's in the trailer of Omari Hardwick's character, Mr., which is just Mr. with a seven space blank line under it. And he's in a hallway full of lights. And that was a location that was a compromise. I know the location we could have used.
Yeah.
And, you know, but anyway.
Does that stuff still bug you sometimes?
So there were a few spots in this place, which are the reason why we ended up compromising and doing it. That was one of the things that was a budget thing. Like, okay, we're just going to have to do this. And so that hallway was one of the reasons I picked the place. And maybe my view of it was like, just we were going to go straight down and we would see the lights disappearing off behind Omari's head. And Doug was like, he didn't say these words, but he just did it. Like, we're going to take this a couple steps higher. And just by moving the camera, his experience and his skill at framing the picture better than I can, you know, that's something that just adds there. So, you know, like Part of it is picking great people who know what the hell they're doing.
Yeah, man.
You know,
for sure. Yeah. Let them do their job.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, it was a great movie. Congratulations. It's really exciting to like, cause you know, we're the same age. I can't imagine, like I got success later in life with podcasting. So you've had your successes throughout the years, but it's kind of cool to be embarking on a new journey.
I mean, yeah. And to the extent that you can always reframe it as success.
Yeah.
But you know, even in my own town, people are like, man, when are you going to make an album? You haven't been making albums in the last 15 years. I'm like, dude, I've been putting out an album like every couple years.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the point is that, you know, and still having, you know, even last year, lights cut off, things like that.
Yeah.
So to what extent is it success?
Mm-hmm.
Those sorts of things, you're always questioning yourself.
Right.
And, you know, probably still will be questioning myself.
Yeah.
You can frame it as success now, but I wasn't always thinking of it that way. And I think that's kind of what also kept me hungry.
Sure. That drive.
You know.
Yeah. Well, backing up, what was your, you got involved in politics and activism at a very young age, but how did entertainment, like, you hear about a kid that's, you know, 13, 14, 15, getting involved in political activism, and you don't think about that same kid going to the movies to see Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
But how did movies and entertainment figure in while you were also doing this very serious, worthy thing?
Well, I mean, I was addicted to television as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I was 12, you know, I was practicing, I was learning guitar, not practicing enough, but I wanted to be Prince.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that what was happening on film screens and television was important.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't feel important.
Right.
I felt like they were touching the world. They were out there and then, you know, and my life was small and boring and, you know, obviously through movies you can travel, you can, you know, you can be in all these situations that seem, even in the drama and scary parts, seem much more of a worthy life than you're living.
Yeah.
And so that was what I wanted to do. My grandmother ran Oakland Ensemble Theater. My uncle used to do one person plays, but I didn't think of those things as connected because, you know, a play has like 30 people in the crowd or, you know, and it's there. You're, you know, like you're there. And, you know, especially some of these things that I got involved with were like storefront theaters, like actual storefront. It still looked like a storefront and had fold out chairs and things like that. So movies and film and music, TV, film and music, that seemed like touching the world. And at the same time, getting involved in youth organizing as a youth, all of a sudden I was helping people we first helped out with this, helped support this cannery workers strike that was going on in Watsonville. And then later on I was doing summer projects, helping out farm workers. And these folks were feeling like they were part of a movement that was changing the world.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden I was getting that same feeling from being involved with something that could actually have an effect on the world, could have ripple effects. The things that you are doing now actually will have an effect on stuff that's going on after you're gone.
Yeah.
And so that felt very, that fulfilled that need. But at the time, I had looked at my interest in, you know, being part of TV and film and music. At that time, I thought of that as an individualistic sort mm-hmm. of thing. I hadn't really figured out why I wanted those things right. in the first place. Why? Only later in life did I figure out that that was the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Who inspired your activism early on? Where did that come from?
Well, my parents had, my father was in the civil rights movement. He was in the NAACP in Durham, North Carolina. Then he joined CORE and moved out to the Bay Area. And him and my mother met during the San Francisco State Strike, which was the student strike that created the first ethnic studies department in the United States. And so they were involved in a lot of stuff. But by the time I was 8, they were burnt out organizers. And
really?
My father went back to school and became a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So although they weren't involved in stuff anymore, I knew that when I got involved in things that I wouldn't be like, you know, as some people were like, you can't come in this house if that's what you're doing.
Right.
You know, or I knew that was not going to be happening.
Mm-hmm.
But I think early on, a lot of my heroes were folks like Fred Hampton and revolutionaries in other countries that
right.
were like in their teens and, you know, making things happen.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, to mix it with music, people like Joe Hill,
yeah.
who were some of the folks that inspired Woody Guthrie and Paul Robeson and you know, those sorts of folks that figured out ways to talk to just everyday people
yeah.
and make them feel empowered.
Yeah, well, and you can kind of, I mean, you definitely see that through line through your music. And then with Sorry to Bother You, you know, you have a statement to make, but you make it in such a, I think satire is such a great vehicle.
And it's weird. I have a weird relationship. I'm still trying to figure that out with the word satire because like satire is what like exaggerating certain circumstances in order to make a point, right?
Yeah. It's kind of
but
hard
that's
to define,
what
but yeah.
every single movie does.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true.
Right? So it's only called satire when it's saying something that the regular general media doesn't say.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, it ends up making you think that nothing else has a statement.
Right.
And this is the only thing that has a statement.
Yeah.
And so you look at that film differently without thinking that, hey, when I'm watching Rampage, there's a political statement being made. And
right.
there is.
Yeah.
But it's just the one that we hear all the time.
Yeah.
And it reinforces all those things. Or when I'm watching, you know, all these things have political statements that they're giving
right.
to us. But so I'm still trying to think whether I want to say this is a satire, because also I think aesthetically of certain things when I hear satire, you know, like Monty Python or something like that,
right.
which I love Monty Python. But,
yeah.
you know, I feel like the thing that I'm doing is a little more nuanced than those things or whatever.
Yeah, for know? Sure.
But I'm sorry. Yeah, I got off on the word satire and I didn't answer
no,
the question.
I mean, I think, that's a tough word to define and you certainly don't want to like put your movie or any film in a box like that. So I get the aversion to labeling something.
Yeah. And it's more of an aesthetic connection that I'm thinking of when I hear that word, because sometimes when something says it's a satire, I don't necessarily want to click on it or
right.
whatever.
Yeah.
Watch, you know, like yeah.
I hear you. Well, I guess we can move a little bit into your movie crush pick. Yeah, we should move on to, I know you sent me a couple of things. You sent Black Cat, White Cat, which we talked before we sat down, is a Serbian film that I was not able to find subtitles.
It's this guy, Emir Kusturica, who I only know a few of his movies, and I like all the ones that I know, although they're slightly racist. But one is called Time of Gypsies. Mm-hmm. One can in that for in 89. Then another one is called Underground, mm-hmm. which one can in like 96. And another one is called Black Cat, White Cat. I also know his movie Arizona Dream, which was Johnny Depp, Jerry Lewis, Faye Dunaway.
Really? Oh, okay. I've heard
Lily
of that.
Taylor. It's a terrible movie.
Is it?
It's a terrible movie. They have a couple really good scenes, but apparently that was his only American movie, uh-huh. and he didn't know how they do movies here. So he was filming. Then he was like, oh, we're going to take a break for a month and then come back. And
yeah.
then nobody was available anymore.
Wow.
But
that's crazy.
Anyway, there's on YouTube, there's a scene from that, which they're at a dinner table. So if you look that up online, look up YouTube. And if you see a scene with Johnny Depp, who else is in it? Vincent D'Onofrio, I think, is in it too. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he does chaos really well.
Interesting.
He is so like he has in Black Cat, White Cat, there's these geese that just come in and fill the frame mm-hmm. like a few times. And I kind of somewhat stole from that. There's this paper that's in the trailer, so I'm not giving anything away, but there's this paper, copy machine that keeps like kind of exploding
oh, yeah.
and filling the frame mm-hmm. and that. Just the chaos and the energy of the camera. This guy, Terry Arbogast, was the cinematographer for that. He also was the cinematographer on the one that people would probably know as Fifth Element.
Right.
And those Luc Besson, mm-hmm. a couple of those Luc Besson movies, I think. Is that Luc Besson? Delicatessen, yeah. too? Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, no. No, Delicatessen was, I think, the brothers, Junot and Corot.
Okay.
But, yeah, I know what you're talking about with that.
So, yeah, like it's
kinetic,
moving, yeah.
energetic feeling.
And, you know, like Time of Gypsies is this movie about this kid who it starts out and he just has this power to just slightly levitate a fork mm-hmm. above the ground, above the table, like a few inches, and then it falls. That's all he's able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes into this story about how him and his sister are basically kidnapped and taken to Italy, and sister's turned into a prostitute, and he's doing all these crimes or whatever, and then he finally escapes and finds his sister, then goes to the gangster's wedding that kidnapped him and is able to levitate the fork up. It can't get to the gangster and is sitting there at the table with him and levitates the fork all the way up and then
right
you know,
through him.
Bullets right through his eye. You know.
Wow.
Yeah. And but Costa Rica has become, I heard he's become pretty right wing.
I got some homework to do there then.
Yeah. After I wrote the script, and I at one point, there was a couple of people I called because I didn't think that I would be able to get it made.
Mm.
So I was like, maybe I could get someone else that's known to direct it, and then it becomes popular, and then I can become a director after that. Luckily, that didn't happen, because what I learned is if I had done that, then I would forever be a writer, and it would be hard to get it. But anyway, so I called looking for this guy, Costa Rica.
Oh, really?
I just, through the internet, found his phone number.
Uh-huh.
And called it, and it was in France, and somebody picked up the phone. I was like, hey, can I speak to Emir Costa Rica? And they were like, he's not here. I'm his manager. And then I was like, told him this thing. He's like, well, I haven't seen him in 10 years, And if I ever do see him, I will kill him.
Oh, my God.
And then
God.
Hung up the phone.
Wow.
So.
That's pretty funny.
And the other person I hit up was Richard Ayoade, who's British, black British comedian who directed a movie called Submarine and directed The Double. And but he's known, I guess the most thing he's most known for here, besides being on the IT Crowd, he's also in the movie The Watch.
Mm-hmm.
He's the guy. But anyway, and he was like, dude, I'm not going to direct this movie, but I'm also going to demand that no one else directs this movie.
But you.
Because reading the script, obviously you have a vision that.
Sure.
You want to put forward. And I was like, well, but I won't be able to get the money for it. He's like, you'll be able to get the money. You just won't be able to get as much money
right.
as someone else would.
But right.
You'll get the money and do it cheaply.
Yeah. That's pretty cool to get. I'm sure that helps your confidence along the way to hear people champion you like that.
Yeah. And so, that's one of the movie crushes, I guess, is Emir Costa Rica, Black Cat, White Cat. But Underground is also a great movie. That's a little bit easier to get Underground, which is a movie about. Underground is a movie about it's Yugoslavia during World War II. Hitler is attacking this revolutionary that's fighting Hitler has his face all over the place. And has to escape, has to hide. So he hides in his best friend confidant's basement. And they hide a whole bunch of people there that are wanted by Hitler. And meanwhile, while the main revolutionary guy is in the basement, his best friend falls in love with the main revolutionary guy's wife, who's living up in the house with him.
Yeah.
Cut to 20 years later, the best friend is lying to the revolutionary guy and saying that Hitler's still out there.
Oh, wow.
It's the 60s now, and they got fake radio broadcasts and fake explosions and all that kind of stuff. And there's a whole community of people living under his house.
Oh, man. That sounds nuts.
Yeah.
Well, I was able to watch this morning, actually, one of your other picks, Mishma, A Life in Four Chapters. And this is the Paul Schrader movie from the mid-80s, a very unconventional biopic of the life of the Japanese writer Yukio Mishma. And I had never heard of this film, and it was unbelievable. It was amazing.
Yeah, it's
such a beautiful movie.
The way that... The story that I just learned about is that it never played in Japan.
I just read that, too.
Yeah.
I was curious about how they felt about it.
It was apparently Japanese gangsters didn't like the fact that it showed that Mishima was gay.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Which was true to life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think probably came through in a lot of his work. But... So I guess a guy had already put in $1 million. A Japanese businessman had already put in $1 million to develop it because Sony Japan said they were going to fund it.
Mm-hmm.
The gangster said they didn't want the movie
right.
in Japan. So Sony pulled out and the guy that had put the $1 million in told Sony, well, okay, if you do this, I'm going to have to commit seppuku. So because that way, his family, the debts are wiped away
right.
from his family.
Interesting.
And they didn't want that on their record.
Right.
So they were like, okay, we'll fund it.
Man.
You can, but it cannot be ever shown in Japan.
Right. Man, that's some serious business.
It's
over
a
there.
Japanese language movie, though.
Yeah. And I mean, I'd never seen a movie quite like it. It was, for those of you listening, it tells the story of this writer's life through black and white flashback as one of the chapters, and then three of his novels are played out on screen, but in a way that it relates and kind of tells his story.
And it's also, those novels are done in a very theatrical manner.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear it's shot on a soundstage. It looks like a stage play, very stylized.
Yeah.
And just like a blast of color compared to that black and white. And it's one of these movies that you can tell it's just a labor of love from Paul Schrader. I think he even said, like, I knew that we would never make a dime back on this movie. But
and apparently he did only it anyway. Also got it made. It was through George Lucas.
Sure.
Yeah. Had to threaten. Had to, like, or no, the George Lucas hit the studio up and said, you know, make this movie. And they said, and I guess he was mad at them for something. And they were like, well, will this make us even? And he was like, yeah.
That's pretty cool. Got to have good friends like that. And I guess in 85, that would have been after Empire Strikes Back. So he had some serious clout
at
that point.
And so, but the other part of it is that how they show the movie is it's in the present as well. And that's filmed differently than the flashbacks.
Yeah.
And there's the flashbacks from when he's a kid. Then there's him as a young man.
Right.
And then there's him getting ready to go take over the fortress.
Yeah, because as the story goes, he is an ardent traditionalist, believer in the Bushido code of the samurai, and this is his true life story. And he goes to the general's quarters or office to kind of stage a revolution, and fails. And that ending is so tragic when he goes out to the army troops, and he's trying to rally them for a coup, and they just are kind of making fun of him.
Yeah. And I think he knew, at least in the movie, he knew that it was just going to be a statement, because his whole thing was that artists, there should be a unity of pen and sword.
Right.
And that he wanted to make a, he wanted, he, you know, he had made his own private army because he was rich, and he also was well loved. So he was able to get basically a cult of people that were his private military.
Yeah, it's like his militia.
Yeah, and he went and took over see, Japan didn't have an army. They only had like a National Guard, and that was his whole point, was like, the U.S. is, you know, we're a colony now.
Right.
And so he wanted to take it over, knowing that he would lose and, you know, but the whole point was he wanted to be able to make this speech to the troops.
Right.
And then kill himself.
Yeah. I mean, it's a story that if I'd seen it and not known anything about the real life, it would have been hard to believe. But then knowing that this was the true story of this guy's life and how he went out is just amazing.
But I think what I like about it is how the story is told.
Yeah, just so creative.
Yeah. And you know, visually, like you said, there's the color, and when they're showing his works, Schrader was saying, look, you know, if you talk about a writer's life, most of their life is just sitting down writing, and it's boring.
Yeah.
You know, and then you're going to try to heighten the other parts. And
yeah,
it's not necessarily that exciting. What's the most exciting about a writer's life is their work.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was like, I have to show his work.
Yeah. It was kind of a stroke of genius.
Yeah. And the score is Philip Glass.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah. And it's very similar to Kalyana Scott. I don't know how you say that name.
Uh-huh.
But you know that the first movie Glass did was, as a score, was Kalyana Scottsky. I don't know how you say it. But and it's more of a tome poem that's like this feature-length thing of all these images that I guess would have been cool before there was YouTube.
Right.
And I mean, not to, but the score is Philip Glass, and it's very similar to the score. This may have been his second one. It's very similar in melody to some of those things.
Yeah, it's just a gorgeous score. And the way he weaves and intercuts these pieces together is just unbelievable. And I knew Schrader's work, and I had never heard of this. So this has been really cool. You've turned me on to a lot of new stuff.
Well, it's like, digging in the crates.
Yeah.
So, I kind of follow trails just to see if I find something
right
that gets me hyped. Even in the, I'll look at really strange stuff that I know I don't like it as a movie.
Mm-hmm.
I like to look at things that failed.
Right.
And not only just to see why they failed, because that really helps, but sometimes there's something in there that they did mm-hmm. really right.
Yeah, yeah.
And which, those things get lost when you throw out the whole movie.
That's a really good point. Not many things are abject failures, and to pick out something cool or noteworthy from something considered a failure.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. Have you ever seen, because I should have put this on there just so we could talk about it. What is it? One from the Heart.
One from the Heart.
So Which One from the it? Heart is Francis Ford Coppola's movie that he did right after Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a musical uh-huh. with Terry Garr. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The opposite of Apocalypse Now.
Yeah. And it's like he wanted to make his cheapest movie ever, but then mm-hmm. it ended up being the most expensive movie that bankrupted Zoetrope Studios.
Yeah.
But the main thing, I don't know. I think the main thing is that the acting is terrible. And, but visually, they rebuilt Las Vegas on a soundstage or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And visually, they do all this crazy stuff with reflections.
Uh-huh.
And like somebody will be sitting in an apartment. And I shouldn't talk about this because I'll probably steal it for something. But, somebody will be sitting in an apartment and there'll be a wall behind them, like they're on their couch
mm-hmm.
in the apartment and the regular, drywall is behind them.
Yeah.
And they'll talk about something. And then all of a sudden it goes dark in the apartment and there's a whole nother set behind the wall that uh-huh. just is able to be seen through the wall because the lights come on through there. And then we travel to that other scene
yeah.
physically, like the camera moves uh-huh. there. And there's so many great transitions
yeah.
in that they did some amazing stuff. And the soundtrack is Tom Waits and Linda mm-hmm. Ronstadt, which is strange.
Yeah, that's an interesting
mix. Probably the corniest stuff Tom Waits has ever done. But I can objectively see that it's not a good movie.
Right.
But throughout it, like every scene, there's something amazing being done.
Uh-huh.
And, it's a musical. So I think they just thought, like they did like an old, like 50s musical where the acting is just over the top
yeah,
every
like the,
second.
The melodrama.
You know?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know.
Interesting.
But, yeah.
All right. Well, we finish up with five questions. If you still have a few minutes, you can be succinct with these if you want, or you can talk more about them. What's the first movie you remember seeing in the movie theater?
Laser Blast.
I don't think I've heard of that one.
Laser Blast is not high culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's I know I must have seen other movies before this, but
yeah.
this is me remembering
sure.
the theater.
Mm.
Like, I remember Star Wars, which had to be before this.
Yeah.
But remembering being in the theater is Laser Blast. Laser Blast is this movie. Actually, Mystery Science Theater did something on it. But
okay.
I saw it at the Lux Theater in Oakland, which was like, my older brother took me, and this was a 24-hour theater where they played kung fu flicks all night
yeah.
and all that kind of stuff. And people go in there to sleep. And
right.
and but Laser Blast is this, it's made in the 70s. It's like a big rock and roll and disco soundtrack. And it's this teenager that's like a biker or whatever. And he finds this this alien weapon in the in the desert, and it goes over his arm like and becomes like an arm cannon or whatever. And he just has this power of this laser, and he can just blow shit up. And he's going and he's getting back at the bullies and all the stuff that happens in those kinds of movies. And you know, arm cannon slowly is turning him into the alien
thing.
And then the other aliens that are the good aliens are coming to try to get the blaster away from him. Because it's a very powerful weapon that they've been searching for. So
laser blast.
Yeah.
All right. I got even more homework. First R-rated movie you remember seeing.
And knowing that it was R-rated and knowing that I shouldn't be here.
Exactly. That's the idea.
I think it was Making Love or something like that.
Yeah.
And I was a kid and my father took me there, and I was just like, it was like him and his friends, and I guess they didn't get a babysitter, so I was there. First of all, it was boring as fuck, but then there was like, I was like, I shouldn't be in here.
Right.
Somebody cover my eyes.
Yeah, that sweet innocence. Will you walk out of a bad movie? Or do you stick
it out? No, I've already told you that, you know, I gotta,
You look for something.
Let's put it like this. Have I walked out of a bad movie? Yes. I can't remember what it is, but yeah,
that's right. You don't have to name.
Yeah.
Who would you cast in the Boots Riley story?
I hope that would never get made.
Okay.
I don't like biopics. Anyway.
Yeah.
Like, it's never real. You know, like, there are things I'm considering doing that are based on people's lives, but it's when I think that what they mean is more important than what they actually did on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. So the idea of sticking to the truth is not for me.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
I would want to tell the truth through them, through making up some crazy stuff about them.
Right. Well, it's no wonder that you love the Schrader movie then. Very unconventional biopic.
Yeah.
And effective.
I like to say biopic, but then everybody keeps correcting me and saying it's biopic.
I've always said biopic.
Biopic sounds better. Bio is life, but instead of, anyway.
Yeah, I'm a biopic guy. And then finally, movie going 101. What's your movie theater ritual these days? Where do you sit? What do you get popcorn?
I go in the middle, like not too close, but in the middle. I like to be able to see the whole frame there. And then, and I don't want to be all the way in the back where there's too much other stuff between the edge of my eyes and the frame.
Right.
And then I used to be like, well, if I go to the movie theater, I can have a Coke. Because I don't, otherwise I'm not trying to. But now I'm going to the movies so much.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're doing a screening tonight.
Of your own movie?
Yeah, so I can't. I don't, you know, so I don't do that anymore. And I'm trying to, you know, taking pictures, you know, went to Sundance and I'm taking pictures next to all these beautiful actors.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, fuck, I got to cut out sugar.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And, So
no more soda at the movie.
Yeah. Go there, preferably with somebody that's not going to fall asleep, you know. I think that's all I have to do is be there in the theater in the middle. And I'm good.
Awesome. Thank you, Boots Riley.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Right,
I got a lot of homework to do. All right, thanks, man.
All right, cool. Peace.
All right, folks. That was Boots Riley. I think we can all agree that he is a stand-up dude, an incredible talent, and a nice guy. He, before and after we recorded, he was just super friendly. And
didn't know me from Adam, but you could tell he appreciated where I was coming from and wanted pictures of us so he could tweet them out, which was usually not the case. It's usually me asking for the picture so I can use it. But Boots is a really good dude, and I hope we get to hang out again at some point. The invitation is open in case he ever comes to Atlanta again. So we had a great talk about Mishima, Life in Four Chapters, as well as some other great movies, as well as his music and his career and his hometown of Oakland. And everyone should support Boots and his efforts. Go check out The Coup if you haven't. There's a lot of great music out there. And starting next week, the great, great film, Sorry to Bother You. Very good movie. With the great Lakeith Stanfield, who is just all over the place these days. So you haven't seen anything quite like this either. So go check out Sorry to Bother You in theaters and support Boots Riley in any way you can. And I will task you with that this week. Until next time, go out and listen to a record by The Coup. Do it. You'll have a good time, I promise. Movie Crush is produced, engineered, edited, and soundtracked by Noel Brown and Ramsey Yunt at HowStuffWorks Studios, Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.